from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Northern California's stunning Monterey Bay Marine Sanctuary is not where you'd expect to find tons of plastic waste. But a new study finds there's enough plastic pollution there to rival the Great Pacific Plastic Patch. We look at the impact it's having. Then scientists say fetal tissue is critical for studying life-threatening illnesses. But on Wednesday, the Trump administration announced it would cut funding for medical research using fetal tissue. That's had an immediate hit on research being done at UCSF. We also look at the broader impact. Join us next on Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. You're likely familiar with the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, the largest accumulation of ocean plastic in the world, the Great Pacific Plastic Patch. Well, a new study finds that our very own Monterey Bay has similar amounts of plastic pollution in the form of bits no bigger than a grain of rice. Monterey Bay has a reputation as one of America's most pristine ocean environments, writes KQED's Paul Rogers in his piece yesterday for the Mercury News. And so this new finding has been sobering for scientists. And joining me is Keith Van Houten, chief scientist at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
And forgive me, it's Kyle Van Houten. I appreciate you being with us. Also with us is Paul Rogers, managing editor at KQED Science. And Paul Rogers, part of the reason that this finding has been so sobering is that they found these plastic bits not only on the surface, but also deep underwater.
Right. When we think of litter and pollution in the ocean, a lot of times we think of big things floating on the surface. And what the scientists here found is that a lot of this plastic pollution are tiny little bits of confetti, essentially, that have been broken up over many years or even decades and washed hundreds or thousands of miles around the oceans. And they found that the concentrations are actually thicker as you go down deeper, 1,000, 2,000 feet under the surface than near the surface.
And Kyle Van Houten, where are these plastic bits coming from?
Well, as Paul just alluded to, one of the things that we found when you imagine pulling all these small bits out of the ocean and trying to identify them diagnostically to what the material part actually is, what we have is a reference library of pristine types, and then we have all these little small bits of microplastic we pulled out of the ocean. They're highly degraded, and that's one of the first things we found, is that they don't resemble the polymer parts that they came from because they've been in the ocean so long and weathered. This indicates, in addition to most of the plastic we actually found was offshore, not near shore, proximate to the coast, indicates to us that these have been in circulation for years, perhaps decades, and have come perhaps from very distant places.
So what you're saying, the further out you go from shore, the more plastic you found?
Correct. We only sampled, our focus in the study was really to vertically profile the water column in the ocean. In other words, to go from the surface down to the seafloor and to do a transect to understand how things varied vertically with ocean depth. However, we did do two sites, a near shore and an offshore site. Obviously, we can't get down to 10,000 feet near the beach. That doesn't happen. But when we go offshore, we found up almost 40% more plastic at those shallow sites. And so, however, we found most of the microplastic far below the surface, between 500 and 2,000 feet down.
So is that why you were able to basically say the new study is basically saying that plastic pollution is everywhere in the world's oceans?
Unfortunately, we do think it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. And the better tools we have, the better technologies, the more places we search, the more animals we search, even remote alpine lakes, very far from metropolitan areas, we're finding plastic everywhere in everything.
And that it rivals or is comparable to the amount of plastic in the Great Pacific Plastic Patch or garbage patch. I kind of use those interchangeably because it's just all trash.
Correct. So this is the first study to really examine from the surface to the seafloor the concentrations as you go down. Now, at the surface of the garbage patch, which has gotten a lot of attention. A scientist, we refer to it as the North Pacific Subtropical Gyre. So that's another one to add as a tongue twister. But the surveys from the garbage patch have been done at the surface, not at depth. And so what we found at depth in Monterey was higher than what they found at the surface of the garbage patch. Why that is troubling is that you don't come to Monterey, as Paul wrote in his article yesterday, expecting to see environmental degradation. It's actually an example of a success story of successful protections. It's a national marine sanctuary. There's sustainable fisheries. A lot of the wildlife has come back. You can see whales here 365 days of the year. However, when you go below the surface, there's a large reservoir of things that we hadn't noticed from the surface. And that what we found is a substantial amount of microplastic.
Yes, Paul, you have written about, as you say, the pristine waters of the Monterey Bay and how, you know, it's not near factories, it's not near industry. How did Monterey come to be a marine sanctuary, and what has it been like for you to learn, Paul, that it is polluted with so much plastic?
Yeah, I mean, I think the findings from the paper that came out yesterday were quite shocking, because for those of us who have followed the evolution of Monterey Bay, in a lot of ways, it really is sort of an underwater Yosemite. You know, there were battles in the 1980s. Longtime Bay Area residents may remember when President Reagan was in office, his two interior secretaries, James Watt and Donald Hodel, talked about their plans to put new offshore oil rigs off of Big Sur and off the San Mateo coast and off the Sonoma coast. And there were, you know, public meetings back then where thousands of people, literally thousands of people, stood in line to testify against them. And there was one in Santa Cruz where Hodel held up his thumb and he said, "I don't know what you're all complaining about. The rigs won't look any bigger than my thumb here from the shore." And, you know, people were still remembering the Santa Barbara oil spill and other oil spills. And so when Congress established that in 1992 and President Bush Sr. approved it, you know, it was the largest national marine sanctuary in America. It's 275 miles of shoreline from the Marin Headlands all the way down to Big Sur. The canyon there, Monterey Canyon, which is just offshore, is 2 miles deep. It's twice as deep as the Grand Canyon. So it's been said that if we drained all the water out of Monterey Bay, we'd be riding mules to the bottom. And, you know, as Kyle just mentioned, there is an amazing variety of sea life in Monterey Bay. Sea otters, gray whales, huge tuna, sea lions, elephant seals, kelp forests, all the amazing things you see at the Monterey Aquarium in those tanks. And we had this view, I think, that despite all the other problems with the oceans, Monterey Bay is one of those places that we really have treated properly. And so to learn that it's got just as much plastic under the surface as some of the other parts of the world that we've thought of as more polluted is, you know, troubling. And I think it's a wake-up call.
Paul Rogers is managing editor at KQED Science. Rogers is also natural resources and environment reporter for the Mercury News. We also have Kyle Van Houten with us, who is chief scientist at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And we're talking about a groundbreaking and sobering study that finds plastic waste, particularly in the form of grain-sized particles, is ubiquitous in our oceans, especially after a study of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary found plastic waste comparable to the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. What are your reactions to these findings? What are your questions for our guests today? They're with us for a half hour, so give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org, post your comments on Facebook, on Twitter, or on our website, kqed.org/forum. And Kyle Van Houten, what effect are these plastic bits having on ocean life?
Well, it's a million-dollar question right there. I think we know that, of course, large macroplastic debris like derelict fishing gears can entangle animals and block their gastrointestinal tract, obviously with acute harm. It can be fatally injurious to those animals. But when the plastic bits are small, how does that affect them? And we're still learning, to be honest, we're still learning about the effects of these. The number one thing, I think, is when an animal is eating small bits of plastic, it thinks it's eating food, but it's not. So it's not getting any caloric value from them. So if I have two siblings and one is corn-fed, so to speak, and one is plastic-fed, one of those is going to thrive and grow and reach maturity at a regular timetable, and the other one's not, simply because it's eating food versus not eating food. But beyond that, the plastic material itself is a contaminant. The plasticizers and other chemicals in those man-made polymers disrupt the natural endocrine systems of the organisms eating them, and they are contaminants. And then beyond that, if I could add a third thing, it's that the little plastic material, as it's floating in the ocean, attracts toxins and chemicals that are in the water column that have nothing to do with plastic, perhaps, to itself, because those chemicals tend to be hydrophobic. And so anything that comes along that's not water, they will attach itself to. So I have a little particle in the ocean that is consumable in bite size for a filter feeder like a shrimp or a crab or a larvation, and that is not food. It is also toxic, and it also gets toxins out of the water column and attracts it to itself. So it's like a triple threat.
Well, let me even go beyond that and ask you how it's affecting us humans if we eat ocean animals with plastic in their guts.
Well, it seems like studies are coming out on a daily or weekly basis talking about the how widespread plastic is in the environment and in the human environment as well. So I'm sitting here at my desk. I'm wearing, you know, a puffer vest, which is made of anthropogenic polymers. I have a plastic pen. I have a plastic case in my phone. I have a plastic computer. But in our food systems, this is becoming more and more described and more known. Bottled water, single-use plastic, and you would get a bottle of water. In that bottle of water is not just water, but also micro bits of plastic from the manufacturing process and the bottling process of that water. It just all sorts of micro particles are sloughing off of our human buildings and our living systems and into our food preparation areas. And it's coming not just from the ocean and things in that food web, but also just from our entire lived environment. It's just covered with these microparticles.
Well, let's go to James in Santa Cruz. Hi, James.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Being a surfer, being in the Monterey Bay, you know, pretty much every week, I've come to realize with the previous story that I heard about plastic being found in the water column all the way down the Marianas Trench, we're watching the degradation of our society in real time with climate change. And now, unfortunately, because of that climate change, the oceans are warming. Once they reach a certain temperature, there's nothing we're going to be able to do. So the acidity level is being raised in the ocean, which not only affects the food chain, I believe some gray whales beached recently, but now we're affecting the very smallest of animals in the food chain in the ocean, and that is just going to spell trouble for all species in the ocean as well as humans on land. So thank you for taking my comment, and great subject.
James, thank you for making that comment. I'm going to go to Vicki in Berkeley next. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. Well, my first reaction is it's even hard to bear listening to it. It's so heartbreaking.
Yes.
And the other part I wanted to really hear as concretely as possible is what we can do as people, what kind of policies we need to change. What can we do?
Yes,
for
Vicki.
Our ocean and ourselves.
Thank you. I mean, are we doomed, Kyle Van Houten?
We're not doomed. I think what's incredibly sobering about this is that with all the effort and all the logistics and planning and rigorous technology to get us down to 1,000 meters to sample this stuff, the irony is that we found that we've already been there, that all the materials from our civilization has beat us to that remote place. But we can, in spite of our profound ability to negatively affect the natural environment, to change our Earth, we also can use that ability and that power to do good things. And 40%, if there's good news at what we found, 40% of the material, the plastic polymers we found, is from a polymer called PET. And that is that when you look at the recyclable triangle, that number one in plastic water bottles, often in food and beverage containers, and, you know, the single-use products, we simply do not need to use these in our lives. And we can avoid them, ask for better alternatives from businesses and from government through legislation. And I think this is good news, because if 40% of this material is something that we can readily curb through very simple choices, that's good news for me.
Well, and you addressed Askel's question, which is, do we know anything about the source or duration of these plastics? Are they new or different age particles in the mix? I'm curious about the duration question. How long does this take to degrade?
We are also curious about that question, and I think that, you know, the adage is that plastic doesn't really break down, it simply breaks up. So while it may start in a very recognizable form, like a toothbrush or a plastic water bottle per se, over time, through wind and weather and sun and algae and barnacles and fish and sharks biting them and like, breaking down in the food chain, things get smaller and smaller. However, we don't really know how long they persist. If they're suspended in the water column, they obviously are traveling through these food webs at the seafloor, at the surface. But I can say the materials that we pulled out of the depths of Monterey Bay were highly degraded. And so this indicated to us that they had been in circulation for years or for decades. But we don't yet currently have a rigorous technology or analytical method to age these materials. And that's something that we're actively working on because we want to know if we were magically able to turn off this spigot of plastic that we're dumping into our natural environment, how long are we going to have this problem for? Is it going to be 30 years? Is it going to be 50 years? Certainly, it's not the level of complexity and broad-scale significance of our global climate system, which if we were magically able to turn off the greenhouse gas spigot, we'd probably still have this problem for hundreds, if not thousands of years. This is not that scale of a problem. But we do believe is obviously wide scale and pervasive and ubiquitous. And we haven't had this problem for hundreds of years. I mean, humans have only been manufacturing plastic since around 1950. So certainly we can make changes and get back to a more sustainable place with respect to the materials that we're putting in our natural environment.
Paul Rogers, also any other thoughts about policy around this and your opinion on these bills that are moving through the state legislature, one in particular that's trying to phase out the sale and distribution of plastics that inched forward?
Yeah, there's really sort of two or three things going on here. The one is it's a global problem. There have been some studies that show that one of the main sources of plastics into the ocean are rivers, and particularly rivers in Asia. And so they're putting in a lot more plastic than rivers in Africa, rivers in North America, rivers in South America. So we need global efforts the way that we've done with the ozone hole and to some extent climate change and trade in endangered species and things like that. Second, the question of what can regular people do, there are a number of things that people can do. They can participate and volunteer in the annual coastal cleanup every September. There's also a lot of creek cleanups that are local that happen throughout the year. You can do that and remove a lot of the material before it gets to the ocean. You can reduce your use of disposable plastic, so that means no plastic water bottles and bringing bags to the supermarket and bringing silverware to the office. You can also recycle plastic properly, so wash things out before you put them in the bin so they're not contaminated and they have a higher chance of being recycled. You can buy in bulk. Instead of buying lots of tiny little packages of things, you can buy a few larger packages. And then finally, you mentioned the state legislation. I think this study is actually going to help boost the chances of passage. There's a couple of bills in Sacramento, real briefly. One's AB 792 by Phil Ting of San Francisco. That would require that all plastic bottles sold in California be made with 75% recycled plastic by 2030. So it's putting the impetus on the manufacturers to basically take the stuff back and recycle it. Also, there are a couple other bills, SB 54 and AB 1080, that are producer responsibility bills that would require manufacturers and retailers to cut the amount of waste that they generate from single-use packaging and plastic products by about 75%. And that could be done by making compostable plastics or by changing the way that they make plastics or making them more recyclable.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, trying to create more of a local recycling industry again in California so we're not just piling this stuff up, shipping it off to Asia where it's being burned and thrown in the ocean.
But Kyle Van Houten, will they make a dent? I mean, Carl writes, for example, does recycling plastics reduce plastic pollution? Because you also talk about this sort of degradation, the sloughing off effect too, correct?
Correct. So a study showed that 90%, globally 90% of what goes into the recycling system doesn't actually get recycled, but actually leaks from that system into the waste management or trash framework. And one of the things that what Paul pointed out is that research shows that these waste management infrastructures around the world, you know, unsurprisingly vary in their quality. And so there's a lot of things. When my first research experience as a graduate student at Stanford was going down to the Amazon rainforest in Peru, and I remember landing in Lima Airport, flying over the coast of Peru, and seeing waves and waves of trash hitting the shore. I was headed to the jungle, and now several years later, I find myself dealing with that very issue here in Monterey Bay where no one suspected it. For me, you know, this paper is a wake-up call. This research is a wake-up call. I think a lot of scientists who study this topic sort of expected this to be coming. They expected this because there's so much plastic being manufactured, so much leaking out our system, and yet no one could really find where all of it was. What's at the surface was only seemed a part of it. But for me, this paper is really about the significance of the deep sea. The deep ocean is not some alien planet with these weird and wild and wonderful organisms that, you know, seem very unfamiliar and foreign to us. The deep ocean is actually the largest ecosystem on the planet. It's where whales and albatross and sea turtles that breathe air like you and me make their living. It is one of the most important, if not the most important, ecosystem on the planet. That's where we found all this microplastic, mm-hmm. and that's something that we really need to care about.
Well, Terry writes, as I ride along local streets, I see the small pieces of trash on the pavement, 100% of which will wash into the drain and go into the bay. Every piece of trash that does not get picked up will go into the ocean. Mm. I often stop to pick up the larger pieces before they get smashed by cars and become impossible to pick up. Kyle Van Houten, we just have a minute left, and I guess I just want to ask you, how are we just realizing this now? I mean, I understand that you know, you use robots to get down into the water to take samples from the deep ocean, but it feels like this, you know, how hard would it have been to take a sample from, you know, some depths and recognize that there was so much debris in it?
Well, certainly the talented engineers and scientists at Ambari, who we partnered with, are really the experts in the deep sea exploration and discovery, where through their rigorous tools and what they've developed enabled us to study this from a quality-controlled scientific standpoint. The problem is that so much of our human apparatus is plastic, so that extends to science too. Our tools and everything are plastic. We had to re-engineer so much of our process to remove plastic from it.
Wow.
So when we went to measure the deep sea, we weren't just measuring our own instrumentation.
Wow, fascinating. Well, Kyle Van Houten, chief scientist at Monterey Bay Aquarium, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for the time. Really appreciate it.
Appreciate you, and appreciate Paul Rogers, our managing editor at KQED Science and Natural Resources and Environment, writer for the Mercury News. Thanks for your reporting on it.
Thank you.
And thanks to our listeners for their questions and comments. Another half hour of Forum is next. We'll be talking about fetal tissue medical research, so stay with us for that. I'm Mina Kim.